Good morning. It is July 26, 2021. You are listening to The Nick Reed Show. I am attorney Kyle Wyatt of Wyatt Law & Associates and Freedom Traffic Law, filling in for Mr. Reed. We got a very special guest, but before we announce, let's have some news.
And your KTTS First Alert forecast. Today, we have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Mostly sunny with a high near 90, but feeling like 100. Tonight, mostly clear with a low near 72. Tuesday, sunny and hot with a high near 93, but feeling like 102. And Wednesday, sunny and hot with a high near 95. Currently in Springfield, it is sunny and 73.
Thank you, Sarah. So we have a very special guest, very happy to have, attorney Rolf Hazelhurst. He is the senior staff attorney for the Children's Health Defense. He graduated from the University of Tennessee and also attended St. John's College in Oxford, England. He received his Juris Doctor degree from the University of Memphis and has been actively engaged in the practice of law since 1995. Before joining the Children's Health Defense, he was an assistant district attorney general for the state of Tennessee. As a criminal prosecutor for over 14 years, Rolf gained extensive jury trial experience while prosecuting almost every criminal offense, from minor misdemeanor offenses to the most serious violent felonies, including first-degree murder. Since 2003, Rolf has fought for the rights of vaccine-injured children. His son's case, Hazelhurst versus Health and Human Services, was the second test case in the ominous autism proceeding under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. He intends to devote the remainder of his life to bringing truth to light regarding the catastrophic injuries and injustices caused by the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Compensation Act of 1986. And if you're not familiar with the Children's Health Defense, that is an organization started by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., commonly known by those close to him as Bobby. And we're very fortunate to have Mr. Hazelhurst with us this morning. How are you doing? Sorry I had to wake you up so early this morning.
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Rolf, you've been actively involved with vaccines and the injuries that they may cause to children. If you can give our listeners just a brief glimpse of how you got involved with this. I imagine it's not something that you were studying in law school.
No, I learned it the hard way. Unfortunately, my son was vaccine injured approximately 20 years ago, and I sought compensation under the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and at the time, I thought, well, I'll fight this all the way to the Supreme Court. Little did I know that 7 years later, I'd go to the Supreme Court, and the journey continues.
And that is something that I guess got recognized by Mr. Kennedy, and this is at least an aspect or part of what Mr. Kennedy has been fighting for. Which is basically bringing to light some of the inherent dangers that pharmaceutical companies have been injecting into our children. Is that right?
Yes. And what most people do not realize is that if you are injured by a vaccine or your child's injured by a vaccine, the pharmaceutical industry cannot be held liable. Basically, if your child's injured by a vaccine, your right to a judge, right to a jury, right to the rules of law, basically evidence, civil procedure, discovery, all of that's taken away. And in my opinion, you're put in a subclass of citizenship where your only legal remedy is something called a special master. A special master is nothing more than a government-appointed attorney. And anyway, learned that the hard way.
Yeah, and this is was all brought to us by a law that was passed in 1986. Does that sound about accurate?
Yeah, to really understand this controversy, you have to go back to the early 1980s. There were lawsuits alleging that children suffered seizure disorders, brain damage, and death as a result of the DTP vaccination. And two things happened. One, they now use a safer version of the DTP, the DTAP. And the second thing that happened was the pharmaceutical industry lobbied Congress for passage of the National Vaccine, the National Childhood Vaccine Act of 1986. And what the act does is it grants, it does several things, but one it does is grant tremendous liability protection to the pharmaceutical industry. And then the other thing that it does is it establishes the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So in theory, if your child's injured by a vaccine, then you're required to sue the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, who is defended by the United States Department of Justice. So you're now up against the full force and weight of the United States government. And there's, again, there's no judge, there's no jury, that's, and rules of law don't apply. That's all been replaced by the special master, the court-appointed attorney. Anyway, you get to about the 1980s, there were lawsuits alleging that vaccines caused autism. And most of those cases were excluded by the very short statute of limitations, but approximately 5,000 cases made it into what it's highly misleading to call it vaccine court, but that's what it's referred to as. So they chose six test cases to determine if vaccines can cause autism and if so, under what conditions. Basically, what happened to those, the decision in those six test cases would determine what happened to the other 5,000 and really every vaccine injured child in the country that claims the vaccines caused autism.
Well, hey, let's talk about that. We're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we'll talk to Attorney Hazelhurst. It's just really shocking, folks, when you get to hear this is your government working for you. And honestly, that's this said with a grin. But you are listening to The Nick Reed Show. All right, welcome back. You are listening to The Nick Reed Show. We are joined by attorney Rolf Hazelhurst, and he is a senior attorney for the Children's Health Defense, a organization started by and ran by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who I hear is working on his book currently about Anthony Fauci. Have you been aware of that?
Yeah, I have some knowledge of it. I haven't read the transcripts yet, but I look forward to reading it.
So we were talking about before the break, you know, what the law of 86 does as far as a pathway for families that find themselves on the business end of an injury due to a product created by a pharmaceutical company. And you were indicating there were six test cases. Your child was one of them, and it made its all its way to the Supreme Court. I guess the big question is, did the Supreme Court make a decision that vaccines were indeed safe and effective?
No. That's the part that always kills. In the case I'm referring to is Brusewitz versus Wyeth. And I'll back up for just a moment. Going back to the Vaccine Act, when it was passed in 1986, it was originally interpreted where you had to exhaust all remedies under the Vaccine Act, and then you could go to state or federal court. So in 2009, when we lost, now all the vaccine-injured children can go to state and federal court. We can finally conduct discovery and hopefully get to the truth. Then there's a case called Brusewitz versus Wyeth. That's the case that went to the Supreme Court. And in the Vaccine Act, it has a one sentence, and I'm paraphrasing, and it says, if the vaccine injury is, quote, unavoidable, then any action against the pharmaceutical shall be dismissed. So it comes down to what does that one sentence mean, a vaccine injury being unavoidable, and who makes that determination? The Supreme Court of Georgia said that's a jury question to decide. federal government said, and the federal court said, no, that's up to the FDA to decide. So that was the issue before the Supreme Court. If a vaccine injury is unavoidable, you can't sue the pharmaceutical industry. So who makes that determination? That's part that just kills me, is you hear over and over, vaccines are safe and effective, safe and effective. Well, they're not 100% safe, and that's certainly not what the government and the pharmaceutical industry and the American Academy of Pediatrics were arguing before the Supreme Court. They were over and over arguing that vaccine injury is unavoidable, meaning if you vaccinate enough children, some of those children will suffer death and serious injuries, specifically brain damage.
And that's the thing that shocked me the most, is that you were physically there in the Supreme Court, sitting in the gallery, listening to oral arguments. And when I spoke to you Friday, the thing that shocked me the most is you said the argument that came from the attorneys for the pharmaceutical companies acknowledging that children are going to get hurt.
Absolutely, because if vaccine injury is avoidable, if it is 100% safe, they don't have liability protection. So they had to argue that vaccine injury is, quote, unavoidable. And if you look at the Supreme Court case of Brusewitz versus Wyeth, page one of the syllabus, Justice Scalia explains that vaccine injury is, quote, unavoidable.
And so with that being said, what if we translate that, what the pharmaceutical attorneys and the government, for that matter, is arguing is that if 100% of or 100 people, 100 parents have their children vaccinated through the CDC schedule, and we can talk about a little bit about that, how the CDC schedule changed after the 1986 law, that it is going to be presumed that some percentage of that. Then I don't know if you're able to state out of 100 what percentage would be injured, but they are expecting, anticipating that some number is going to be injured lifelong and maybe even death. Is that right?
I think at the time what they were arguing was 1 in 10,000.
And so I guess that's the gamble that you make as a parent then, isn't it?
Yeah, you're playing Russian roulette. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If enough children are vaccinated, it's presumed some of those children will suffer death and brain damage.
Yeah, but that's not what's being told to parents through their pediatricians, though, is it?
No, not at all.
You and your wife were similar to mine, our family, that, you know, when you had your son, you walked in and you knew that, you know, well, when I grew up, I was vaccinated. My wife was vaccinated. The doctor's telling us, you know, our firstborn child, here's the schedule that you need to do. You follow those recommendations, right?
Yeah. I'll say this. If it had not happened to me, I would not have believed it. In the beginning, I didn't believe vaccines could cause autism. I thought there's no way vaccines could cause autism. If that were true, then there would be massive class action lawsuits. You'd turn on the TV and you'd see advertisements for law firms suing the pharmaceutical industry. And the reason you don't see that is because you cannot sue the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, and the information that is provided to us is mainly what from news media. Well, who's one of their largest advertisers?
My personal opinion, the pharmaceutical industry largely controls mainstream media, and they largely control the regulatory agencies that are supposed to protect us.
Right.
There's tremendous financial conflicts of interest in play.
All right, let's take another little quick break here. We'll be back here with Attorney Hazelhurst. All right, welcome back. You are listening to The Nick Reed Show. We got some weather for you.
Well, your first alert forecast today, we have a slight chance of showers this afternoon. Mostly sunny with a high near 90, but feeling like 100. Tonight, mostly clear with a low near 72. Tuesday, sunny and hot with a high near 93. And Wednesday, sunny and hot with a high near 95. Currently in Springfield, it is sunny and 75.
Thank you, Sarah. We are joined by senior attorney Rolf Hazelhurst for the Children's Health Defense. And the conversation right now is you know, about the vaccines and the procedures and process. And when we left off, there was an argument in front of the Supreme Court that Mr. Hazelhurst attended, where the government and the attorneys for pharmaceutical companies admitted that there is risk, and I guess it's unavoidable risk, is what they would argue, with their product, that there are going to be some children that are going to be affected. And even if you say 1 in 1,000, we know there are millions of children that have to be, or I say have to be, but there's, well, in some states, it's absolutely mandatory. Before you can even go to school or daycare, that you have to have a part, you know, you have to have your schedules from the CDC vaccines, that there are going to be some. And so as a parent, you're going to have to weigh those options and play, like you said, Rolf, Russian roulette, that you just accept the risk that your child could get affected.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's why fighting the D.C. Minor Consent for Vaccination Act Amendment is so important, because this is, to me, the most outrageous abuse of power in a vaccine law in the country at this time. Now, there's going to be more, so that's why we have to fight this fight. But would you like to talk about the D.C. Act for a moment?
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to that real quick. But you had brought up something on Friday in our conversation, and this is the fact. Not you're not giving an opinion, but the schedule that the CDC has provided as far as mandatory vaccines, but at least recommended vaccines for our children, changed after the 1986 law.
Yes, the 1986 law calls for a close working relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the federal government. And once the pharmaceutical industry was granted protection from liability, you can't sue them, the amount and number of vaccinations dramatically increased. Before, it was the MMR and the DTP in order to go to school. After that, they just kept adding more vaccines and more vaccines. And because each vaccination that's added to the recommended schedule equates to at least an extra $1 billion per year in revenue. I think they're now up to 15 or 16 vaccinations that are on the schedule. So you ask yourself the question, well, who decides what vaccines children must receive? And it's the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices. Now, most of the people sit, it's a group of 12 doctors, and they really wear two hats. They, on the one hand, they've got their doctor hat on, but on their other hat, they're work for the pharmaceutical industry. Or I will say there are tremendous financial conflicts of interest in that the members of the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices profit directly and indirectly by adding vaccinations to the schedule.
You were telling me that there was one that was on the committee that actually had a patent for one of the for the vaccines that they included into the schedule.
Yeah, the Dr. Paul Offit, we call him Dr. Profit. the mainstream news media and government, pharmaceutical industry hold him out as a frequent spokesperson for vaccines and autism. He's not an expert in autism. He is an expert in infectious disease. But anyway, he sat on the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices when the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices voted to add the rotavirus vaccine to the schedule. So in essence, he voted himself to be a multimillionaire. If that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what is.
And so that brings us into some litigation that you're involved in on behalf of the Children's Health Defense, where the city or the District of Columbia passed a I assume they call it an ordinance.
It's a law.
Okay.
It's an act.
Because I know in cities we call them ordinances. I didn't know about the District of Columbia how they reference their legislation, but nonetheless, so they passed a law, and give the listeners a view of what this law states.
I'll read it to you. It says a minor 11 years of age or older may consent to receive a vaccine if the minor is capable of meeting the informed consent standard, and the vaccine is recommended by the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices. Now, as far as meeting the informed consent standard, it just has a vague explanation of what that is, that the child can is capable of comprehending the need for, the nature of, and the significant risks inherent of medical care. To me, it defies common sense to think that an 11-year-old can meet that informed consent process. And other than what I just read to you, there's no other definition of what that informed consent process is under this law. And 11 years old, that's...
Oh, I know. I got a 12-year-old that I can't trust his judgment. If it was up to him, he wouldn't go to school. He'd stay at home playing on his iPad or Xbox.
It's a couple of years beyond believing in Santa Claus.
in that regards, who's the one who is determining that minor has the ability to comprehend the need for?
It's in essence whoever's administering the vaccination, but it's basically driven by the government. And so you're turning your 11-year-old child over to the government and whatever. And they have tremendous peer pressure. I'll give you an example here in Tennessee. It doesn't apply to D.C., but it's just an example of the tactics they will use. At a school in Chattanooga called Macaulay, the prestigious boarding school, they basically announced that everybody, that if they had 500 children that got the vaccination, then nobody had to take their final exams. Well, that's tremendous pressure to put on children, because a few holdouts that don't get vaccinated, they're going to get beat up by the seniors because they don't want to take their final exams. Everybody gets the COVID vaccine, we'll have a pizza party. You know, it's absolutely absurd to put an 11-year-old child in that position. They could easily be coerced, and they don't comprehend the risks and involved. And most, this brings me to another portion of this act. The very next part states that the health department shall produce one or more alternative vaccine information sheets, which shall be made available before vaccination of minors, to support the provider's use of informed consent. And I'll explain what that means. Under the Vaccine Act of 1986, Congress mandated that parents are to be provided with vaccine information statements. What these one-page front-and-back document states is what the vaccine, the disease is, what the benefits are, what the risks are, but most importantly, that some children should not be vaccinated. Children that have what are called precautions or contraindications to vaccinations, previous allergic reactions, previous seizures, should not receive the vaccinations. And this is mandated by federal law that is basically, when they took away the right to sue the pharmaceutical industry for making a defective product, the only legal right you got is this kangaroo court called vaccine court and this little piece of paper called a VIS form that explains to you some children should not be vaccinated and how to recognize a vaccine adverse reaction. There's a very real danger here if a child goes to school in the morning. The parents don't know that the child is vaccinated against their knowledge and consent. They come home. If the child has an adverse reaction, the parents are not provided with the information necessary to recognize the vaccine adverse reaction. The child could start to have a seizure. The parents have no clue that that seizure is being caused by a vaccination that the child received at school earlier that day that they have no knowledge of.
Well, when we come back from the break, we'll talk about there's more into this law that deals with what information the health insurers is allowed to give other parents. And then we'll talk about what you are doing in the fight against this ridiculous law that unfortunately is not just happening in D.C., but it's being considered in other cities across our nation. You are listening to The Nick Reed Show. Welcome back. You're listening to The Nick Reed Show. I'm attorney Kyle Wyatt filling in for Mr. Reed. And we are fortunate, and I do mean that, fortunate to have senior attorney for the Children's Health Defense, Rolf Hazelhurst, with us this morning. We're talking about there is a D.C. law that was actually passed and enacted. It took effect, what was it, March of this year? When did it take effect?
I believe March. It was passed in December, and because D.C. is not a state, there's a waiting provision where Congress can, in essence, it's called resolution for disapproval. Congress could have overridden this law. They could have, based in essence, what we would think of as a veto. They could have vetoed the law. There was a resolution passed. It split right down party lines, and it didn't. The resolution of dissolution was not approved, so the law went into effect in March.
And it shows even more how important elections are federally.
Absolutely.
Amazing. So if it wasn't enough that the parents could be left in the dark about their 11-year-old child getting poked with a number of vaccines, I mean, I don't think there's a limit, is there?
The limit is all the vaccines listed on the advisory committee, all the childhood vaccines.
Yeah.
It's not just COVID-19, it's all the vaccines.
And so if that wasn't enough, there was a provision for instructions to health insurance providers.
Correct. And this act has several provisions in it that are all designed to deceive the parents, to hide from the parents the fact that the child has been vaccinated without their knowledge, without their consent. And even if they've submitted submitted a written directive for their child not to be vaccinated. And that's where this next provision comes up. And this has to do with EOBs, or explanation of benefits, the notice that you get from the insurance company that your insurance company has paid a bill. The D.C. Council realized, oh, wait, the parents are going to figure this out when the bill goes to the insurance company. The insurance company pays the bill, and then they send an explanation of benefits to the parents. The parents are going to figure out their child got vaccinated. So then they added this provision, and I'll read a portion of it to you. Providers who administer immunizations under the authority of this subsection shall seek reimbursement without parental consent directly from the insurer. Then it goes on to say, insurers shall not send an explanation of benefits for services provided under the authority of this subsection. So they went out of their way to make sure, okay, the parents going to pay for it. We are not going to let them know that they've been vaccinated. Tyranny is the word that comes to my mind. It's just outright deceitful.
And so, in essence, are they instructed, the insurance providers instructed to, that if a parent calls and says, hey, I got this bill, and I haven't gone to the doctor, I haven't taken my kid to the doctor, what is this bill about? What is the insurance company required to tell the parent?
It does not specifically say that, other than it says not to send an explanation of benefits. So I would interpret that to mean the insurance company cannot tell the parents. Now, it does specifically talk about that the school system shall not tell the parents. That's the next section. I'll read this to you. If a minor student is utilizing a religious exemption for vaccinations, in other words, if the parents have filed a religious exemption, which in the District of Columbia, you have the right to a religious exemption, I'll read on, or is opting out of receiving the HPV vaccine, the health care provider shall leave blank the immunization record. So the law requires the health care provider to leave the health care record blank. But then it calls for a separate, in essence, a separate record. It said the school shall keep the immunization record received from the health care provider confidential. So there's two sets of records. The parent goes to ask for the child's records. They're given a record that is blank that shows the child did not receive vaccinations. But the health care provider submits a second record to the school system. Now, the child is entitled to get a copy of that vaccination record, but the parent is specifically prohibited from receiving a copy of the child's medical records.
Well, we got about 4 minutes left, so can you tell the audience then, what has the Children's Health Defense done to combat against this piece of law?
Well, Children's Health Defense, we partnered with the Parental Rights Foundation, and we have filed a lawsuit in the District of Columbia. We are seeking for an injunction to stop the continued enforcement of this law. School goes back into effect, August 30th, and we are doing our best to get in front of a judge before August 30th. We're asking that the law be declared unconstitutional on three grounds. It violates the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution because the D.C. Minor Act completely contradicts the mandatory provisions of the Federal Vaccine Act, the reporting and recording requirements. So there's no question it contradicts. The second ground in the lawsuit is that it is unconstitutional and that it violates religious freedom. The third is that it's unconstitutional in that it violates the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, in that it violates the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. If it were a state, it would also violate the 14th Amendment. But anyway, the Due Process Clause protects liberty interest, and the oldest liberty interest recognized by the Supreme Court of the United States is the liberty interest of a parent to raise his child. So we've filed this lawsuit. We're seeking an injunction. I believe it'll have oral arguments sometime after August 25th, prior to August 30th. But we'll do our best, and hopefully we will prevail to stop this insane law.
You know, we do adoptions at our office, and it's been compared to when you do an adoption, you're terminating a parent's parental rights, and it's sacrosanct. You know, as far as the Constitution and, as you said, the Supreme Court holds it. And it's been equated to, it's the equivalency of the death penalty, but in civil court, because you're terminating a parental's rights to a child. And this law, like you were stating, is terminating that parent's right and authority over a child and placing it in the hands of a government official.
That's a good analogy, excellent analogy. But I'll go one point further and point out the obvious. If your child's injured, the parent is the one left to take care of the child for the rest of his life. I know that from personal experience.
Yeah, and we've been talking about that throughout this morning. You know, when you have employers who are mandating vaccines just for them to work, that there's no recourse against that employer if that employee is injured. And we know, as a matter of fact, that the people who have received the COVID vaccines, there's been all sorts of different complications with that. But yet there'll be no recourse for that employee against the employer. Although I noticed, though, that the Children's Health Defense did send a notice out. Rita had sent it to me earlier this morning. I don't know if you were a part of it or not, but sending a notice out to employers that you guys are watching them.
Oh, yeah. We have to pick and choose our legal battles, but that is one that's high on the list of priorities.
If individuals are concerned about this and care about this and want to support what you are doing, how can they help the Children's Health Defense?
Go to our website, childrenshealthdefense.org. You can become a member. It's only $10 for a lifetime membership. We want to encourage as many people as possible to join, so that you'll get a it's called the Defender is our email, our internet letter, and it daily we have updates on information, what's going on. If you did any one thing, I would go to childrenshealthdefense.org and visit our website.
Absolutely. That's a small price to pay. Rolf, I really do appreciate you giving us some of your time this morning, and we look forward to hearing from you as the days go by. I really do appreciate it. Appreciate each and every one of you for joining us this morning. I hope each and every one of you have a fantastic Monday. We didn't get to play our song, but, you know, there's always next time. But anyway, have a good day.